countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Caller Gas, celebrating 80 years, bringing energy to Ireland's homes and businesses.
Good morning and welcome to the programme. Coming up between now and 9 o'clock, the government's carbon bill, reaction from farmers and environmentalists. Ella explores the magic of her native woodlands. Brenda does a bit of drama. And we talk to economist Jim Power.
Text 51551. Email countrywide at rte.ie and tweet at RTE Countrywide.
But first, over the years, I've been lucky to visit hundreds of farms in Ireland and abroad. Big farms and small farms, farms of all shapes and sizes. But today I've come to what I would safely say is the smallest farm I've ever visited. I'm here in County Carlow, just near Garry Hill, and I've come to visit a Polish woman who set up her farm here 7 years ago. She's the first of her kind in Ireland to do what she's doing. She is a snail farmer. Her name is Eva Milka. Eva, how are you? I'm great. Thank you very much for having me.
I'm going to
stand my social distance
yes.
now. So I am probably on the smallest farm I've ever been on. How big is your farm?
Well, we operate on half an acre. We've started farming snails back in 2013. So back then, it was back 2012, we talked to people a lot. Some people laughed at us, as you can imagine, and some people still laugh at us, believe it or not. But some people encouraged us to conduct initial market research, so we did, and we discovered a massive market opportunity there, and we said, why don't we try? So we did.
Okay, well, you know, let's walk this massive farm. So
come on.
we're at one end of the field here. So you have basically your half an acre just right down here, and the harvest has just finished.
Correct. Our eighth harvest 2020 is over. Yuppie!
So will you take me through a typical year on a snail farm and the life cycle of the snail?
Yeah, so we, Damien, start in January with breeding. Breeding takes place in our love room. This is where the snails are mating and laying eggs.
And that's just over there behind us?
Correct, yeah. Yes.
In an old stone house.
You can see the red door there. 3 months of breeding. Then we keep our baby snails in the polytunnel for 4 to 8 weeks. And from May until September, they're all outdoors.
So on a half acre, what's the yield?
You can produce up to 5 tons on half an acre of land.
And it's surrounded by fencing and covered on top by a net. Why is that?
We are using our external fencing is made out of corrugated iron sheets to protect our snails from land predators, such as mice and rats. And the netting is to protect our snails from the birds,
okay,
which absolutely love snails.
So what was the 2020 harvest like?
It was great because the summer was amazing. It was warm and wet, and this is exactly what you want when you farm snails. It's a very clean type of farming.
Okay, and the end product is called escargot.
It's a French name for snails. It is a French delicacy. It's very nutritious. It's very high in protein, very low in fat, very low in calories. It contains nearly all these amino acids needed for the human body. So it's very healthy food.
Right.
Have you ever tried escargot, Damien, before?
No, but I have a funny feeling I'm going to.
Let's go to try some.
First time for everything. What's the name of your dog?
Bonnie. She's a New Zealand Hontaway.
She's beautiful.
Oh, she's like my baby girl.
So we've reached the house now. I'm going to stand here at the door.
Perfect.
And we're going to leave the microphone sitting there.
Right. And I'll cook some escargot for you. Just take a few minutes.
So how popular is escargot meat in Ireland?
Well, Ireland, the market in Ireland is very tiny, Damien, as you can imagine. As I said, we have the psychological barrier to break in order to start eating more escargot.
But Irish market is very interesting market to investigate more, to be investigated more, an ideal market to build our brand.
The name of your business is Gaelic Escargot.
Correct.
So where do you sell your product?
When you look at the markets in general, the three biggest markets are French, Italian and Spanish. But we are currently working with an Irish distributor who is specializing in exporting Irish food to Singapore. And this is what we are aiming for. We are looking to focus completely on the Middle East market for many reasons. A, it's a small market and we are small producers. And B, they have an amazing appreciation for Irish food and they are willing to pay premium prices for premium Irish products.
Right. And how do you harvest the meat or process it once the snails are fully grown? Do you do that yourself?
We don't. We are outsourcing our processing. So what we do is we just farm them on our farm and then they are sent to be processed.
Okay.
They all hand-picked, so the harvest is always a hands-on stage. It's fun. Farming is very therapeutic. You feel alive. You feel, energized. But it's definitely not for everybody. I just opened the jar and then we just throw them on the pan, lots of garlic butter and voila!
It smells gorgeous.
Did you have to register with the Department of Agriculture for your business?
Yes. Believe it or not, we had to apply for the herd number. So we have a herd number like beef farmers. So we are registered with the Department of Agriculture.
Thank you.
Damien, here's the moment of truth. Bon appétit. That's an escargot fillet with homemade garlic butter and some calendula petals.
It's chewy.
Yeah, okay.
Chewy meat.
Is it like a meaty mussel?
Mm-hmm. This is beautiful. So this is ideal, as an appetizer.
Damien, there are so many things you could do with escargot fillets. Sometimes we add them in a scrambled egg in the morning, just for the higher protein count. You can use them in pasta dishes. You can use them with the risottos. I remember one of the chefs from Pichet in Dublin. He created this beautiful dish. It was a parsley risotto with some of our escargot and the parmesan shavings and rocket on top of it. So it was a beautiful dish. You can deep fry them tempura style, like your fish and chips. You could make an escargot omelette or maybe a paella style dish. So there's so many things you could use.
Well, I'm not just saying it's absolutely
and
gorgeous.
You're eating more. I'm impressed.
I am. Well, listen, it's been an absolute pleasure meeting you. Thank you so much for showing me your business, and I want to wish you all the very best in the future.
My pleasure, Damien. Thank you so much for having me on your program.
Full of the joys of life. That was Eva Milke there on her small snail farm in Garry Hill, south of Fenna in County Carlow. I chatted to her yesterday. Now, she also trains people to snail farm, and you'll find details at www.gaelicescargot.com. Gaelicescargot.com. And she runs it there. She was talking about we earlier on. It's along with her partner, Owen, who I met there yesterday, and the dog, Bonnie, as well, who had a lovely welcome for me. Anyway, Brendan Dunhugh, good morning to you.
Good morning, Damien. And I've always a lovely welcome for you as well.
You do.
You're doing good today.
And especially this weather, because this week I've seen a big change. Driving to Carlow yesterday, I could see the trees changing colour. Getting up this morning, it's that little bit colder and darker. And we're entering the winter now, and with all the problems that we have, for a lot of people, an escape obviously is, if you're into sport, you play with the local club or whatever, or you go to the pub or you go out for a meal. But for an awful lot of people in rural Ireland, in the cities, but also throughout rural Ireland, amateur dramatics is massive, and there's an awful lot of societies dotted all around the country, and it culminates, of course, with the All-Ireland final being in Athlone every May. This year it was cancelled like everything else. And more bad news this week, Brandy, you've been finding out.
Yeah, I have. Well, it's interesting because today, Damien, as you know, is World Mental Health Day. Mm-hmm. And I think what you just touched on there with kind of the rural communities, but it doesn't matter where you are, if you're involved in a drama group, a panto troupe, whatever, those small relationships with others in your neighbourhood and community, they're very important to our well-being and our happiness. And you don't need me to tell you that this pandemic has made it really difficult to keep in touch. But you talked about the RTÉ All-Ireland Drama Festival there, cancelled in May of this year, and this week they heard the news that the festival won't go ahead in 2021. Now, it's very hard and it's a lot to come to terms with for all those. I mean, you were talking about hundreds of drama groups all around the country, between the one-act festivals, the three-act festivals. It is the pinnacle. You're rehearsing three nights a week, then you're maybe doing it at the weekend, you're doing the set. I mean, I love it. I've done pantos for years. That there's nothing like that moment when another opening, another show, and you're on stage. It is a wonderful, exciting thing to be part of, even if the crowd don't like it. But even going to the shows themselves. So it's very difficult for people and very hard to come to terms with it, even though people are being innovative about how they try and keep those connections going. But anyway, I went to Athlone. And I met Regina Bushnell. And Regina is the festival director for the RTE All-Ireland Drama Festival. And I called to see her. And bear in mind, we just heard the news that the festival for 2021 wasn't going to go ahead as it would normally. And straight away, she'd something she wanted to show me.
Wait till I show you what I have here.
It's a box.
It is a big box and it is so heavy. It actually takes two people to lift this box.
Wow.
You just opened the door. It is the pride and joy of the theatre groups who get their hands on it. And right now, it should be sitting maybe in a theatre someplace or in a hallway so that it can be displayed. Isn't it absolutely beautiful? It is the RTE All-Ireland Drama Festival trophy. It's sitting here in my home since the festival was cancelled. And so much work goes on in the groups that the group that wins this deserves it and deserves to have it on show.
Are you a little bit emotional, Regina?
I am a little bit emotional looking at it because, you know, I mean, it is such a wonderful time. Drama has meant so much to me in my life. I suppose to see it cancelled like this is just, it's a huge blow. It's part of the culture of Athlone. It's part of the heritage of Athlone. It's part of the culture and heritage of drama all over the country. And yeah, I am a bit emotional looking at it and saying, OK, right. And I suppose even more so because we can say now there will be no circuit. It has been officially cancelled. The festival as we've known it over the last 67 years is not going to happen It hasn't happened in 2020 and it's not going to happen in 2021. And that makes me really sad. It really does make me sad and emotional, you know.
Well, Regina, I'm not immune from a bit of drama myself on many levels, and I have been to Athlone to the All-Ireland Drama Festival, and I know it's about the quality of the play, but really it's about the socialisation.
Absolutely. There are so many people where the drama group in their community is the most important thing to them. Our evenings are getting darker and it would give you something to put on your lipstick for me, or maybe me high heels.
Because I love
for
high
the
heels.
Boys. Let's not be. Yeah, not the boys. And it'd be looking at how you just get out to meet people. You know, discuss what's going on in the community, but to take part in the whole thing of putting on that production. And when that production goes on stage and the communities who go to the theatre come in and look at it, like, it just comes alive. The whole thing just comes alive. My drama friends have been part of most of my whole life since my teens. And it's the same for a lot of people. And people move maybe from town to town, and the thing that they will do is go to the nearest drama group and get involved there. So it gets them to know people in their communities and gets them out. And like, you're looking at ordinary people who go to work, some of them who are in their 70s and 80s and would still be there and are still involved in drama, because you can be.
Regina, before you put the trophy back in the box, I think it needs a bit of a clean and a polish there.
I think that's a very good idea. We'll give it a little polish and hopefully it'll be in somebody else's theatre or somebody else's home by this time next year.
Ah, Damien, that is Regina Bushnell there, the festival director with the RTE All-Ireland Drama Festival. And she said to me that the committee are currently working on plans with the Amateur Drama Council of Ireland to see what is possible in 2021. What can they do to keep people together? But I really want to get a sense of what it's like to be a fully committed member of a drama group and how this pandemic is impacting on them. So I went and I visited a lovely gentleman and his wife, Jimmy and Mary Grace. They live in Bracken and County Offaly. Jimmy, since 1983, is a member of the Prosperous Dramatic Society. He loves it and he's missing it so much. And I know that in Prosperous, they're trying to figure out at the moment, can they do a traditional pantomime on Meets or on Zoom? But I was chatting to Jimmy and he began by telling me how he's putting in the long hours now that he doesn't have the drama to keep him occupied in these dark evenings.
It's an awful vacuum and it's looking around into how to fill the vacuum. I've been reduced to doing jigsaws. That's how bad it is. And, I have the newspapers read from cover to cover and spending a fortune on newspapers. It's the lack of mental stimulation. The drama does that. While I wouldn't be the best actor in the world, the drama is a great mental stimulation. It makes you see things that you otherwise maybe be too lazy to look at. I'm going to miss it like hell. We just have to make the best of it.
What are you missing at the moment?
I'm missing the camaraderie, the people, the crack, the company. My good lady here, wife, is keeping me sane at the moment. Only for her I'd be lost.
Now, you brought up your good wife, Mary. You're with us here. Mary, what's it been like having him at home all the time?
Well, it's very, very different, Brenda, to say the least of it. He absolutely loves the drama. And from September to May, I hardly ever see him. He's gone practically all week and certainly most of the weekends. He's missing the drama dreadfully. I know he is. To be honest, I don't think either of us are looking forward to the dark evenings and the long winter because there's nothing to replace the drama for him. You can only do so much reading. There's only so many books and there are only so many things on the telly that you can watch. So, yeah, it's going to be a long winter.
Thank you, Mary. She's all right, isn't she?
She'll do. I won't get another one that good so handy.
Yeah. Oh. If you look ahead a couple of months and you've had, say, no rehearsals, no show, no oil paint, how will that make you feel?
Quite bereft in some respects. We're going to have no show for quite some time. It could be a year before we have a show because it's the social distancing that's killing it. I tell you, it knocks the love scenes out of the park anyway. Although I'm a bit old for those.
Never say that. You've been involved in over 20 productions with Prosperous Drama Group. That's amazing. Mm. Do you have a favourite, by the way?
Well, personally, it was we did Juno and the Peacock here in 2013. And I played Captain Boyle and it was my favourite part. It was the part of a lifetime and I loved every moment of it. And the only regret I had is we only got to do 5 shows.
Oh, I know you've the script there. Will you give me a little blast of Captain Boyle?
We'll have a little look at this. What is the star speech? Often and often when I was fixed at the wheel with a marlin spike and the winds blowing fierce and the waves lashing and lashing till you think that every minute was going to be your last. And it blowed and it blowed. Blue is the right word, Joxer, but blowed is what the sailors use. And as it blowed and blowed, I often looked up at the sky and asked myself the question, what is the stars? What is the stars?
Jimmy, I was with you there. Thank you.
It's just great.
Oh, that's
just great.
Yeah, Jimmy Grace, Captain Boyle, Ploughing the Stars, nothing like it. To everybody, I suppose, in the amateur drama circuit, you know, the best of luck. And if you're involved in your local community and you've come up with, I suppose, an innovative way, a great way to keep in touch with each other during COVID, please let us know, countrywide@rte.ie or Twitter @RTE Countrywide. We would love to hear about it. We'll talk about it. We'll do what we can. I might come down and visit you. And I just want to say before I go that Jimmy Grace there, it's not a roundy birthday he's having today, but it is his birthday. So happy birthday, Jimmy Grace.
Happy birthday, Jimmy Grace, from all of us here on Countrywide. And still to come on Countrywide, economist Jim Power, walking our native woodlands, and the climate bill discussed.
You're listening to Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Follow us on Twitter @RTE Countrywide.
Now, since March, a regular on the programme throughout the summer has been economist Jim Power, a friend of the programme, and we said we'd give Jim a buzz again. Good morning, Jim.
Morning, Damien. How you doing?
You've been kind of keeping us up to date on where we're going throughout the summer, and I saw Pascal Donoghue yesterday saying that the deficit this year is going to be 21 billion. We spend 21 billion more than we're taking in. Now, the good news is that there was talk it was going to be 30 billion. So, I suppose, what about that 21 billion deficit? Is it manageable?
Okay, yeah, 21 billion is penciled in. And as you say, back in July, the department was suggesting 30 billion, which would have been manageable. So 21 is very manageable. It's about 6.1% of GDP. It's big, but in the circumstances, I don't think we should be concerned about it. Two things have really happened since March. One is that the income tax take has held up quite well. That's because a lot of the higher paid workers in the economy, in foreign direct investment, financial services, public sector workers, they continue to earn and they pay most of the income tax, whereas is those that have been worst affected are lower paid workers in the hospitality sector and retail who don't get paid as much, don't pay as much tax. That's one thing. The second thing is, and I think this is really important, because we hear a lot of criticism about foreign direct investment and its impact and influence in the economy, but there's been a massive growth in tax revenues paid by the multinationals this year, and that is saving us as well in the circumstances.
And so is that because of our low corporation tax rate that attracts them here?
It is indeed, Damien. Two things. We've seen 245,000 jobs supported here at the moment by multinationals all over the country. And the second thing is that over the last few years, because of international tax changes, quite controversial globally, a lot of intellectual property assets have moved in here. And while, you know, not a lot of tax is paid on them, some tax is being paid, and the Irish Exchequer is benefiting from that.
Yeah.
So in the current circumstances, to be honest, FDI is an important anchor for the economy, as indeed is the agri-food sector, which was the case again back in 2007-2008.
Okay. Now, Jim, why are we able to borrow at near 0% in the markets?
It's because the European Central Bank has ensured that we can. The European Central Bank, and indeed other central banks around the world, the Bank of Japan, the Bank of England, the Federal Reserve in the United States, they have been going into the markets buying government bonds. And when you buy government bonds as a central bank, as a central bank, the price of the bonds rises, the yields fall. Okay, there's an inverse relationship. So by buying bonds, they're pushing bond yields down. And that's what they've been doing aggressively, because they want to make sure that countries around the world, particularly around Europe, including Ireland, are able to borrow as much as they need at the moment to keep their economies and societies alive. So that ECB strategy is the reason why Ireland is now able to borrow for 10 years at virtually zero. And that is really, really important in the current circumstances. And of course, the hope is that the European Central Bank will maintain this stance for at least the next couple of years, because it is going to take some time, obviously, to get back to some semblance of normality. And in the meantime, and I think correctly so, governments are going to run big deficits, are going to spend a lot of money to try and keep their economies and societies alive.
Okay, we know, obviously, we discussed Brexit in the past, and we had John Bruton last week painting a very bleak picture of a no deal and the effects on the Irish rural economy and farming in particular. But you have another worry, and that is the US election. And if Donald Trump wins, the possible impact that that might have. This is not an anti-Trump thing we're going on, but you feel that his stance in relation to free trade could affect us.
Okay, I've looked, obviously, we've all looked at what Trump has been doing over the last 4 years, and he's had a very, very belligerent attitude to international relations. He's had an ongoing trade dispute with the Chinese, which incidentally does get a lot of popular support in the United States, because the latest polls I saw show that over 70% of Americans are not happy with the behavior of China. So we've seen that trade battle go on. But, and I think this is what concerns me, is that he has also turned his attention on the European Union. And I fear that if Trump were to be re-elected, that all hell could break loose thereafter, because I think, you know, he wouldn't have to worry about a re-election. So I think he could really up the ante and really damage global trade, and particularly trade between the United States and the European Union. That would not be good for Irish farming, there's no doubt about that, or indeed for European farming and the agri-food sector.
Right.
Biden, on the other hand, I've looked at what his key policies are insofar as he has elucidated what they are, but, you know, he wouldn't necessarily roll back on this protectionism that Trump has introduced, but I don't believe he wouldn't accelerate it, and I think he would be much more conciliatory. And I think Biden would recognize the importance of a good relationship, yeah, political and economic, between the United States and the European Union. So, and maybe I'll be blatantly political about this, I really, really do hope In terms of global political stability and economic stability, right, that Biden actually wins the election.
Right.
I think it's important.
All right, Jim. Finally, and very, very briefly, speaking of farming and trade, the Mercosur trade agreement, now under some pressure with a European Parliament vote against it this week, is it a fatal blow?
I think it was always going to be incredibly challenging to get Mercosur across the line because it is full of inherent inconsistencies, particularly about the standards that apply in Europe to agricultural production and so on, and the standards that apply in the Mercosur countries. We were told that there would be serious regulation of how Mercosur production, the Mercosur countries produce food and so on, but I never believed that was going to be possible. So it was, against that backdrop, you know, I think Mercosur is definitely in trouble. And I think European farmers can breathe a sigh of relief for the foreseeable future. It's going to take a lot of work to get across the line.
Yeah.
Because I think it's inconceivable that you could have Mercosur countries getting free access to Europe while at the same time not applying the standards of production that European farmers are expected to adhere to.
Yeah, and that has always been the worry. Jim, thanks a million for that. Let you out for your ramble now Saturday morning as you usually do on the bike. So thanks very much for chatting to us this morning. We'll touch image again in a few weeks.
Always a pleasure, Damien. Happy 10-10-20 to all your listeners, okay?
Happy 10-10-20, yeah. Farmers Day, Fertiliser Day today. All right, we're getting lots of texts on that, by the way, as well. All right, Jim Power there. Now, I have a lovely book in front of me. It's called Wild Woods, The Magic of Ireland's Native Woodlands. It's written by Richard Nairn, who himself bought 20 acres near Ashford in County Wicklow a few years ago. He's planted thousands of trees on his land, and Ella McSweeney went down to meet him on a windy fresh morning during the week.
I've lived in this area for over 40 years. I suppose I'm still regarded as a blow-in. I've been walking the area for years, of course, and I knew the valley and a lot of the fields. And then the land, this particular small holding, came up for sale 4 years ago, and we bought it. We fell in love with it, and our first priority was to plant some trees and create shelter and create a habitat for biodiversity. Well, we're heading just down the hill to our old woodland site, because within this property there are 3 acres of old native woodland.
And how old?
Well, we reckon from the old maps it's at least 200 years, and some of the trees are certainly big enough to be that.
And we just come in.
Yeah, we're walking along a muddy path now.
Yeah, lovely and squelchy.
It's a good place actually to see tracks. I often pick up the tracks of deer, badgers and even pine martens along here.
And presumably otters, given you've got a river.
Yes, I've photographed otters on this river. So I've taken you in this way because we're going into a clearing, which we've made in the wood. And one of the problems with old woodlands in Ireland is that they're underused, neglected, and there's not enough light. So if you look in that area, it's full of dense holly. The tree canopy is very closed. And during the summer, this is quite a dark area. And we found that we had about 10 mature sycamore trees, which are non-native. We employed a tree surgeon who took those out very carefully. And into the clearings then, we planted hazel.
And what happens in what is quite a dense wood like this when you take trees out?
It allows the sunlight to come in. And as we look up here, we can see a big opening in the canopy, which is a beautiful sunny patch during the day. In the light you get a huge growth of wildflowers in the spring, butterflies in the summer, and a myriad of insects.
I think during the lockdown earlier this year you quickly heard of, you know, people's desires to get into nature, but particularly woods and woodlands. You know, this notion of being around trees as being something that is soothing and healing and helpful to our mental health. Did you find that?
Yes, I think I immediately recognised that when I came to the wood. It's an experience a bit like going into a church, because in a cathedral you look up and you see the beams in the church holding the roof. And a woodland is a bit like that. We have huge trunks here holding up a canopy over our heads. And I think the experience you get is could be similar to a religious experience, a kind of feeling of stability, long-term security, and a sense of peace and quiet. This muddy path you have to be careful on because after rain it becomes quite slippy. And I'm continually trimming the brambles here because they will arch over the path and make it impassable in a couple of weeks.
Well, they just engulf you, don't they? Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're walking alongside a stream. There's ferns everywhere, holly, and then a big pile of wood. Fantastic.
Yeah, this is seasoned holly and some alder in here.
This is for burning, I presume.
Yeah, this is for domestic firewood for our own heating at home. Yeah. It can be very slippy, especially after a night of rain like we've just had. So I've had to put down these bridges across the streams. The river changes its course from time to time. After a few days of rain, it breaks its banks and all these little channels become flowing streams.
So there's planks of wood for bridges and you can just walk across them easily.
Some days I come down and half the planks have been washed away. But I usually fetch them from further down the stream and put them back again.
Are you down here a lot on your own, Richard?
Yes, I am. And I've got so used to it I could... I know each tree almost intimately along the path.
Do you have a favourite tree?
I think the alder has to be my favourite. It's associated with the river. There's all along here there's some lovely alders just on the edge of the stream. It's actually quite a useful tree as well. It has a beautiful red colour to the timber when it's cut or when it breaks. They put their roots into the water and they have this ability of stabilising the river banks. So in an area where there's bankside erosion, alders planted along a woodland stream are really helpful to stop the erosion.
And suddenly, as we came around the corner there, the stream sort of has picked up into what you would consider a small river here. And having that sound in a wood is exceptionally lucky, isn't it?
It's a very relaxing sound. And I often sit here for a while and just listen and look at the water moving past. I've had trout here. You can see how clear and clean the water is.
Beautiful.
Thankfully, it's that way most of the time.
And when did the idea of writing a book come to you? I mean, you've written so many books in your career. I suppose, you know, it starts to become very obvious when you spend time down here that there is something to say.
Since I've known this woodland, I've kept a daily journal, writing down my observations. If I find a woodpecker nest, I'll make a note of that. If I find droppings of a pine marten, I'll note that down as well. But also any of the management we've done, like the coppicing. After a few years, that builds up into quite an interesting picture, and I thought I'd share that with other people. I realised then that the woodland provided a kind of sanctuary of peace and quiet, away from the madness of virus across the globe.
And what do you think you have learned from this wood?
I've fallen in love with the place, but I've also learned a huge amount in a short number of years. And the principal lesson is that natural habitats need managing. The present fashion of rewilding is fine for huge areas like Yellowstone National Park in the United States. But for the small landscape that we have in Ireland with multiple ownership, and tiny patches of remaining habitat, and they need managing and they need a helping hand, and that's the way I put it. We're not taking over in a commercial sense, but we're managing this to assist it to move in the right direction to increase biodiversity and make an even richer place for nature.
And that's Richard Nairn there, whose new book, Wild Woods, The Magic of Ireland's Native Woodlands, is published by Gill Books and is now on sale. And he was chatting there during the week to Ella McSweeney. Now, earlier this week, the government published its Climate Action Bill, an important piece of legislation and a major step in the journey to try and make Ireland net carbon zero by the year 2050. Now, each of the key emission sectors, such as, for example, transport, energy and agriculture, will be given five-year budgets or ceilings on emissions, and it's going to be reviewed on a yearly basis. We're going to just focus now on agriculture, and maybe even more specific than that, on the dairy sector and what it needs to do in terms of helping us meet our targets. And I'm joined by Sive O'Neill, who's coordinator of Stop Climate Chaos, and Thomas Duffy, a dairy farmer and president of Machrane & Fermoy. Thank you both very much for joining us this morning. Sive, I might begin with yourself. Are you satisfied that in agriculture, and specifically in dairying, that the sector is working at ways, as they say, to find ways of reducing emissions?
Good morning, Damien. Well, firstly, I just want to say that we broadly welcome the bill. It does represent a milestone in climate policy governance and addresses a lot of weaknesses that were in the existing legislation. So the bill sets a target for net zero by 2050. And even if this isn't necessarily consistent with the most recent IPCC science, it does mean that by 2050, Ireland's residual emissions of greenhouse gases will have to be balanced by removals. Now, when you consider that we're currently emitting 60 million tonnes per annum, and we have about 13 tonnes of carbon emitted per capita, which is very high across Europe, that's a very significant and ambitious target. One third of all of Ireland's greenhouse gas emissions come from the agriculture and land use sector. And as we've discussed before on this programme, there's a worrying projection and increase in emissions that are largely due to the intensification coming from the dairy sector. So while the other sectors are showing some stabilisation and gradual declines in emissions, by no means not reaching any targets yet, the problem is that the agricultural sector isn't showing yet that clear reduction in emissions. Mm. So when the bill is implemented and enacted, it will propose a system of carbon budgets. And the critical point here is that these will apply across the economy. They will cover all sectors and gases. And then after that, once they're adopted, the minister is going to propose sectoral carbon budgets called decarbonisation target ranges in the bill. And these will set targets for each sector. And there will be a numerical target for the first time established in law for the agricultural right. sector. And that is highly significant.
OK, Thomas, it's highly significant. There's going to be a target. But Sai's saying there's a clear, clear evidence that there isn't a reduction actually happening in your sector?
Well, I suppose the first thing to point out is the statement that there's reductions happening in all of the sectors broadly is not actually accurate. The private transport sector was increasing globally as well. The actual aviation sector is predicted to be the fastest growing sector in the world, and including in Ireland. So we need to be realistic here for a second. I think there are three elements of the bill that we do need to recognise that are very, very important. A little bit of a departure maybe, and a recognition of what the different aspect to agriculture. It was highlighted by Tánaiste at the press conference that the bill does refer to the important and concerning risk of carbon leakage, particularly, and I note the discussion you just had there about Mercosur and the Mercosur deal, and that was actually referenced directly, that if we reduce production in Ireland, it's very likely to go somewhere else. So we need to recognise that. The social and economic status of agriculture and that is fundamentally the underpinning of the entire rural economy are both two elements that are called out specifically. And then again, in terms of methane, because methane is the real question here, and it's the real important gas, I suppose, over the entire thing. And recognising, in line with the best science in the 2018 IPCC report, which it calls out in the bill itself, which is a bit unusual for a legal bill to reference a scientific document, but it's excellent to see it. Now, biogenic methane will have to be dealt with differently. Mm. And when we read that report, we see that it's defined as a short-lived climate-forcing gas. And I suppose that's not a get out of free by any manner or means, but the way that we handle methane is going to have to be different to the way that we handle carbon.
And there's a lot of focus, Thomas, on the dairy herd, which has increased in the last few years since the abolition of milk quotas, with the suggestion that cow numbers have to be reduced. Can that actually happen, and how can that happen without impinging on farmer livelihoods?
Well, I suppose we have to be very clear here. If the aim is to reduce both the methane and the overall carbon budget of agriculture, the number of cows is one element of it, but the actual intensity of methane production per animal is also a major issue. Now, this is a huge challenge for agriculture, as Macra has said. I mean, we need to see ambitious targets for all of the sectors, and we do need to address it, primarily because your listeners today, Damien, many of them being farmers, are going to be the first people to face climate change. I mean, my land can't move. You can, if you're working in an office, you can pick up your office and move to somewhere else. But I mean, if my land dries out, if my land floods, I really am going to be at the coal face of.
But are there other ways of reducing the impact?
Yes. I mean, we have a number of different ways that are being developed. And I suppose, I know we're talking here about the dairy herd, but certainly the dairy beef is one element where we can see potentially huge drop-offs, because about 700,000 dairy beef animals are produced this year. If we look at the research coming out of Chagas, for instance, and just to talk about methane, there's a potential by just reducing the age at slaughter, by improving the genetics of those animals, to achieve a 10% cut in enteric methane across the national herd. Okay. I think in terms of the dairy herd, we're going to have to look at two separate sets of things. One is changing feeding and maybe the potential for methane reduction.
Okay, so feeding and breeding, Sive. There are ways of actually reducing emissions, reducing methane levels without actually impinging on farmer livelihoods and on cow numbers.
Well, the first thing to say is that we support the need for a just transition for farmers. We're not opposed to farmers having a sustainable livelihood, and it's vital that we have a just transition that allows farmers and encourages farmers to protect biodiversity, to produce food in ways that do not cause damage to the environment or the atmosphere. But just to say as well that about 100 years ago, we might have had 2 million head of cattle in Ireland, and we have 7 million now. It's misleading to say that we have to stick with the number of cattle that we have at the moment. That is a policy choice. And this policy choice, which has been driven by the attitude to the milk quota abolition, has actually generated more emissions. We are relying on more and more nitrogen fertiliser to produce more grass per hectare to increase the dairy herd and increase milk production.
But isn't demand growing? The global population has increased, and demand from developing countries for proteins from animals is continuing to increase. And if we don't produce it here, it'll be produced less efficiently elsewhere. That's an argument that's put. What do you say to that?
Well, I would just say that we have to live within our ecological limits, and we have to respect planetary boundaries as they apply to Ireland. And we don't have an unlimited resource here. We have water pollution, biodiversity loss and greenhouse gas emissions, and also ammonia, air pollution as well, as a result of this intensification. And it's unsustainable. So there may well be demand globally. But is it sustainable for the Irish landscape to be sacrificed so we can export dairy milk protein to China, for example? We don't think this is a sustainable model.
But we're just passing it on to some other country.
Well, the point is we are polluting our own environment to generate commodities that we're not even consuming ourselves. They're for export. The net value to Ireland, I think, is highly questionable. So the point is, what's the future for farming? The future is in diversification. The future is in land management, supporting biodiversity and nature-based solutions. And we support CAP reforms and the biodiversity strategy that's coming from the EU to encourage and incentivize farming practices to change. We do need a new model, because the current model is unsustainable.
OK, we're going to leave it there. Thank you both very much indeed. I know it's been a short little debate. We still had the guts of 10 minutes there, but thank you both very much for giving us your points of view on that. And it is a subject that we will be returning to on the programme next week, and indeed subsequent to that. But Thomas Duffy and Sive O'Neill, thank you as always for joining us on Countrywide, which is at an end until I talk to you at the same time next week. Stay tuned for playback after the 9 News here in Radio 1. But as I said, until I talk to you at the same time next week, bye-bye and thanks for listening.
You can listen back to today's show on rte.ie/countrywide.